This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released December 20th, 2020, episode 522, High Current Power Supplies with Frederick Kinsander. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Frederick Kinsander of Kraft PowerCon.
Welcome, Frederick. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Thank you. Nice to be on the show.
Yeah. You actually wrote in about this. I think you're actually one of our first guests from Sweden.
Yeah.
Maybe. Oh, actually, Simone might be from Sweden. I don't remember where she's from originally, but she doesn't live in Sweden. I'm trying to think of other guests we've had maybe, but maybe our first guest from Sweden. So
yeah, maybe. Yeah, I remember some episode with some guy with that Swedish-like name, but I don't think it was from Sweden. Yeah.
So what is the electronic scene like in Sweden in general?
The industry is quite high tech, I would say. Mm-hmm. My first job was in Linköping, and worked at a company that did encryption stuff. It was quite high end. Yeah. And we have Saab, which does the fighter jets and like that. So that's quite.
I think my former company has some headquarters there, SE Brown Bavari, or ABB.
Yeah.
I think that's part Swedish, part Swiss. So
ABB is a big one.
Which is like a weird bedfellows. It's like, oh, okay. those countries both start with S. So.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I mentioned ABB too, because it's like, we did some high power stuff, but it seems like, you're also doing high power stuff. And so tell us about what you're currently working on.
So I work at Kraft PowerCon, where we make what we call rectifiers. And as I mentioned before the show, when I applied for a job here, they said like, okay, we make rectifier. And I was like, okay, that's four diodes. What's next? No. So it's basically switch mode power supplies for high current and high voltage.
Yeah. And like, give us a range. Like, what are some of the power envelopes that you work on?
Yeah, it's like the 100 to 200 kilowatts range for the big products, I think. Mm. We even have some that goes up to 700 kilowatts that we make in India, those big things. And so we have different sites. We have both in Sweden, we have in India, we have some stuff going on in China, and we have some sales office in the US and different places.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like really specialized equipment. So I would imagine that it's like where you need this kind of power, you're just... people are seeking you out and they're like, yeah, I just have this one need to do this sort of thing.
Yeah. And there's like different product areas. So the high voltage stuff is used for cleaning exhaust gases from power plants and the like. Mm-hmm. So you put like 100 kilovolts on metal plates and you attract particles. Yep. And then you can like have big mechanical hammers that hammers on the plates and the particles fall down and gets collected. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's like a not like like a industrial process, like a it's like in a smokestack or something.
Yeah, so it's in the smokestack, and they can have different. It's called electrical precipitators, those kind of filters.
Yeah, versus like I guess another way of doing that would be like actually passing this particulates through like a filter medium, but then you'd have to switch that out. So this actually allows it to be reused over and over.
Yeah, I guess the flow is much better in this case. I guess you would restrict the flow very much if you had it. And then you can't really maybe collect all the smallest particles that way.
Yeah, oh, right.
So because there's a lot of emission controls going on, and I actually know a guy that works like that. He goes out and measures chimneys and ensure they follow the regulations.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I knew someone who used to do that, and he had to go and like inspect towers. It was in Ohio, so like the towers weren't that tall, right? You know, there wasn't like a huge thing, but he would get regularly, like he'd be like climbing towers and like all these birds that are making nests up there, they'd come and just like swoop on him because they're like, what are you doing to my home?
Yeah.
You know, so, but he just had to go check the filters, so.
Yeah, and the products we make for that area, they actually live on top of the power plants, so.
Oh, wow.
They are from like minus 40 degrees Celsius to plus 50 degrees. So there's some harsh environment requirements.
Yeah. What about like, I mean, I guess they'd have to run power up to that too. So they'd have to have like lightning arresting and similar kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
I guess so. I haven't been up there myself, but
yeah. I'm more of a ground-based creature myself.
No, but the power, the mains power is like to one rectifier can be 250 amps of three phase. Wow. So yeah. There are some big cables going up there, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Huh. And so is that that's the ones that you're working on, or are you working on something else?
No, I'm working more on the high current ones. So okay. That's like for electroplating, putting metal on stuff. Surface treatment like that. So you dip stuff into a chemical bath and you put a lot of current on it.
Yeah. And what kind of currents are we talking about here?
Yeah. Here we talk about like 1 kiloamp to 30, 40 kiloamps.
Okay. All right. That's some amps. Yeah. So then at the power envelope, so 30 kiloamps, and that would be what, in like the 50 volt range? Like what's the voltage then?
The voltage is, for the electroplating stuff, it's 10 volts maybe. Mm-hmm. They go up to 12, and we have some cases with 20 volts. Yeah.
Mm, okay. And then, so, like, about the electroplating process too. So like, what about the high current? Like, why? I guess I don't know how electroplating works in the first place. But like, so you're passing current through a liquid, and then is it like is the thing that you're trying to plate that acts as like an anode or a cathode? Is that
exactly. You dip it down, and it's one part is the anode, and the other part is the cathode. You put a lot of current in it, and I guess the metal that's in the solution that gets put on the thing that you want to plate.
Okay. Yeah. And so it's just the high current is just for higher throughput or higher amounts of plating or whatever?
Yeah. So the bigger the area, I guess, of the object you're trying to plate, the more current you need, and the faster you want it to go, the more current you need. And it's also used for like for PCB manufacturing, you know?
Oh, cool.
Because you put copper on the PCB, so the same kind of process.
So this would be done at the actual board house, or this would be done at a manufacturer that's making like a prepreg that has like pre-populated with copper on it or something.
It's at the board house where they actually make the PCBs.
Oh, okay.
So, and the simplest one is the DC, but we also make pulse products. Okay. Because if you're gonna plate like a through hole in a PCB like a via. It's hard to get the same amount of copper in the hole as you get on the surface of the board. So the aspect ratio, the higher the aspect ratio goes, the harder it gets. So it's like I was just reading, they see they will use a lot of pulse plating for new 5G boards because like the back planes are usually thick boards, maybe 4 millimeter thick. And if you have a via that's like 0.25 millimeters, the aspect ratio is really high.
Yeah.
So they use something called reverse pulse plating. So maybe you go first positive pulse, and then you go negative a couple of times higher than that. And these products goes in the sub-millisecond if you want to. So that's quite fascinating also.
Yeah, that's great. And the same kind of power or current levels, huh?
Yeah, that's like, I think our product says 100 amps to 2,400. So it can be kiloamps. So maybe you go 100 amp forward and then 1 kiloamp backwards, and you have a pulse that's 1 millisecond or 0.5 millisecond long.
Yeah. I feel like I would love to see like a science educator do like an illustration of like how the ions are moving. Like I guess like kind of, I kind of get an idea why a pulse would matter to get it down into like a high aspect ratio via, but I don't understand the actual like physics, like why a pulse versus like a sine wave or, you know, like that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. For some reason, it's like, I read a little bit about it, but it's like if you do DC, the most ions will go to the high current density areas. And you have higher current density on the top side and bottom side. You don't have so high current density in the hole before you get copper down into it. So, and the pulse helps to get the copper down into the hole.
Got it. Okay. So it's like instead of like slapping paint on the outside, if you're like painting a car, you wouldn't use like a paintbrush. You use like one of those Mister, you know, like those a spray gun type of things instead, and like you use a pulse at a time to get it. Like, okay, all right, yeah. I guess that makes it like intuitively. I guess that makes sense, but like it seems like there's physics at play that I just don't understand.
No.
I think the closest I would have is like when I used to do like dry etch. You know, like it was always hard. It was similar, like hard to do really high aspect ratio, like vias or etching, you know, through holes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd have these weird recipes for it, but it wasn't necessarily pulsed so much. You know, there's always like RF stuff happening, you know, weird 60 kilowatt thingies. I really didn't know what I was doing there. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, do you get to go and visit some of the places that your stuff goes into?
Yeah, I visited one place that actually just a few kilometers from here where they're making PCBs, Kogra, it's called. But they have some what I think it was just the DC products, so not the fancy pulse. Although most of the pulse products is in like China.
Okay, yeah, like super, super advanced type of boards and mobile type things.
Yeah, also like that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I never really thought about that with like, you know, you can get like laser micro, like we talked about last week on like with Bunny's, Bunny Huang's post about the laser micro vias and on that board that he was making. And it's like, yeah, okay, I kind of get like the making of the board, but then you think you gotta plate everything too. And that becomes really, really tough.
Yeah.
What elements outside of PCB plating are these used in? So you said electroplating and then PCBs. Are there other industries?
Yeah, ballast water treatment is a really big one. So you know, big cargo ships, they have some, when they have offloaded their cargo, they need ballast water in the tanks to stabilize the ship. And if you pick that water up somewhere and then you go across the globe to some other country, you don't want to let it out because you could bring marine life from one area to another one. And it actually became a legal requirement just some year or something ago. There's been a lot of debate about it, but it finally became legal. So all ships must have it. So now it's a really big industry. And I was fascinating like a year ago to see our volumes go 10 times up. What we made in a year, we suddenly made in a month.
Holy moly.
So.
Yeah, that's got to be some interesting requirement. So first off, I remember like when I was like in school, it was like zebra mussels were like this like invasive species in the Great Lakes where I grew up. And so that was like a big thing. And, you know, these tankers would come in and they'd be dumping zebra mussels. And so like that was like a thing that I learned about. And it was basically that problem, you know, they would come in and do that. But the interesting thing I would think is don't marine electronics have like 400 hertz, like aren't they kind of like airplane electronics, like weird like onboard generation capabilities?
And they have higher voltage, so I think the normal three phase voltage is 440 volt.
Okay.
So, and they can go up to 480, and then when you make a product for that voltage, you should also go plus 10%. So we tested up to 528 volt.
Okay. Yeah.
At the same time, we should also work at 400 volts so we can test it here in-house.
Right.
So it's put some requirements on the primary side of the rectifier to be able to cope with that range.
That's pretty extreme, huh? It's extreme even at 400 volts. Let's be honest. This is way outside the realm that I'm usually working at. So So let's talk about like safety a little bit then. So how do you keep yourself safe when you're like in the lab and working on this sort of stuff?
Yeah. We have like, first of all, we have a safety manual that you should know about and follow. And like you should know when you're working on free phase, and you should try to put some protection on it so you don't touch it by accident. And also we try to...
So that's like covers or what are we talking about here?
Put some plastic covers on it. Like the products are made relatively safe, even if you remove like the front panel. So they can be maybe IP44 with the front panel on. And even if you remove it, maybe it's IP21 or something. So you cannot accidentally touch things with high voltage.
Oh, okay. I don't know. These are like, whenever I hear IP, I always think of like waterproof standards, but these are like.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's IP21, but it's basically you cannot get your finger into it in the dangerous area. But if you open it up so you can get your finger on that part, so you could put some plastic cover on it. And if you're doing some really dangerous, you can have one of your colleagues standing at the emergency breaker.
Yeah, so that's good.
To pull that one if something happens.
Do you do reflex testing for your coworkers?
You're like, no, I have sometimes.
Like, hey, Bob, how you feeling today? You got good fast reflexes?
Yeah, it can also be when somebody's like about to do something and you make like a high-pitched sound and they think there's a spark, they sometimes jump up. If you want to mess with them.
I try not to mess with people with high voltage around. Yeah, that's
So that's the one side. And then you have the output when it's like, if you have one power module with 300 amps out, you put it into a resistor and that resistor usually starts glowing. So yeah, at least it will be orange. And I've been told to stop before it gets white.
Okay. So like color temperature type stuff.
It can get hot in the lab. Yeah,
I was gonna say Sweden is not the winter's here, and so you know it's helped to heat up the office. I'm sure you know, like everybody's got space heaters built on their desk.
Yeah, the lab is always hot, and I know we had a period when we were developing a new power module, and that power module is 20 kilowatts. So you had a 20 kilowatt heater going on in the lab for a few hours.
Do you have like specialized ventilation then to try and like cool things down, or is it just like you just deal with it?
No, you just deal with it. But we also, it's a big factory. So the lab is rather small, but if you go out to the big factory and find some open space and you have a couple meters up to the roof, it gets easier because the heat rises.
Yeah. Oh, so you do manufacturing on site?
Yeah. So we manufacture everything here.
Nice.
So that's kind of nice because when I work on stuff, I can go out and pick up a PCB fresh from the production line.
What kind of capabilities does your production line have?
You mean how many of one thing we can make?
Actually, I meant how small can you go if you need to?
Okay, no. So we're not making like PCB assemblies. We purchased the PCBAs from our suppliers.
Okay.
So here we assemble the product. So we have some metal casing. We put in the heat sinks and the boards from, like for the primary switching boards, the transformer, the secondary diodes, some output filter board. And everything is assembled on a line, and then it goes to some module testing if you look at the modular products.
So I imagine your test stands are pretty interesting too.
So it's that one is like a big hood that goes down over the module automatically to like protect you, because it's the first time you power it on, some things can go bad, so it's good to have safety for your workers.
Yeah, especially in an automated way, right? It's just like, it's just, they walk away and it's just doing its own thing.
Yeah, so it's a hood goes down over the power module, and then there's some automated testing going on, making sure the output is correct and it following the specs.
Yeah, so that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Is there like calibration that's required in these kind of devices?
Yeah, some have some calibrations, and because we have a quite big range also, so some of the oldest power modules for the high current side, they are analog. So you have some trimmer potentiometers and stuff like that to adjust. And then you have the digital power modules, and those also have some kind of calibration in the menus of the software.
Switch it out to DACs instead of trimmer pots.
Yeah, and it's even like that. Like for the latest product we made sure it could self-calibrate itself. So the output should be really exact from the power module. There should be no question about it. But we still had to put some calibration menu inside, because when that one gets to a customer and they have a current meter, they clamp it on and they say, no, it's not showing the correct value.
So maybe that
meter is not calibrated, but they still want it to show the correct value. So they want to be able to adjust. So,
I guess what I was wondering there too is like how much requirement is there for like, so if you're pumping 2000 amps into a vat of copper, cooper chloride or whatever is actually plating, do they care if it's like 1 amp, 0.1 amp, 0.01 amps, you know, like less than that? I don't know.
I'm not so sure, but they still want like, 1% accuracy, less than 1% ripple.
Yeah.
So yeah, 1% on 2,000 amps is 20 amps.
Yeah, that's plus or minus 20 amps. It seems doable, but at the same time, like that's a lot of swing. Like that's just a lot to get right. You know, like, that's
And then you all have all these chemists that are making these recipes, and they specify it should be like this. Mm-hmm. And you could argue that maybe it's not so important, like it's exactly the, like if you have a pulse, does it matter if it's exactly a square wave or not? But if the recipe says a square wave, they want a square wave. So
yeah, chemists, you know,
deal with it.
Okay. Well, can you walk us through like a, you know, like an audio block diagram of what one of these systems looks like? It doesn't have to be like exact to the actual thing, but like you mentioned, you know, primary, secondary transformers, things like that. Like what's actually happening internally on one of these boxes?
So we could start like on the big stack level, because we assemble usually like 10 of them into a stack. So on the stack level, the free phase comes in and you usually have an EMC filter to cope with EMC requirements. So, and then it goes, the power goes to a 24 volt supply that will supply all the control boards with 24 volt voltage, and then it goes down, the free phase goes down to all the power modules. And on the input of the power module, you have a small board for connecting the free phase, and you have some fuses, and you have some kind of common mode choke to take care of some EMC requirement as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then after fuses, you go to a rectifier bridge. Then you come on to the what we call the primary board. And the primary board has the IGBTs that switches the rectified voltage. So you also have some cap, but it's not so big on our products, like a DC link cap. So you said
a rectifier, but then also IGBTs to do like active switching. Is that the idea?
Yeah, so it's primary side switching. So you rectify the free phase into like a 700 or 800 volt DC.
Okay.
And then we in this like these high current products, we have like a half bridge. So you have one high side and one low side IGBT.
Okay. And, like a push pull kind of topology kind of thing. Through like a through a transformer?
Yeah, through a transformer. So I think it's called just half bridge. And you have some two DC caps that has a midpoint. So the midpoint of the transformer on the primary side is into two caps. That's between the plus and the minus on the DC link. So you have half the voltage over the IGBT. Okay. If you would have a full bridge, you would have the full voltage. But in this case, you have half voltage. So that's the benefit of the half bridge, but instead it has higher current than the full bridge.
Yep, got it.
Yeah, so that goes into the transformer. Then on the output of the transformer, you have the secondary diodes, because now it's switching, so now it's not DC anymore, it's AC, sort of. Yep. So switching at like 37 kilohertz for that one. And then you have some interesting phenomena also when the diodes are like, they are alternating in their conduction. So when one starts to block, you have the reverse recovery. Basically, you need to send some current backwards before it blocks. And when it blocks, the resistance basically goes infinite. So the current must go somewhere. So you have a voltage spike. So you need a snubber. So there's like an RC snubber on the diode taking care of that voltage. Since these are quite big,
designs. I was gonna say, I'm like thinking about the power. You know, we're talking about here too.
Yeah,
it's like big, probably voltage spikes. But then if you're just snubbing it, that means it's just burning up as heat, right?
Yeah. So maybe, but not so much. Maybe 5 or 10 watts in heat on the snubber, but still you must cope with it.
Yeah, I just mean like, I mean, relative to like, so like people who are listening right now, they're like, my product doesn't use 5 or 10 watts ever. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, just these scale differences are so great.
Yeah,
it's not awesome.
And the voltage spike is on some products, so to be like maybe 480 volt on the secondary side.
Wow.
So there are 600 volt diodes there. So. Yeah.
Wow. And it's just, is it just a one-to-one transformer as well?
No, transformer is maybe 13 primary in one product, it's 13 primary turns and 3+3 on the secondary because you have a center tap.
Okay, yep.
And also because of that topology, so when you block the voltage with the diode, you basically block double the output voltage. So for like a 50 volt power module, maybe you will have 90 volt out if you have high mains, because you want to have 50 volts even when you have low mains.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. And that's what you were talking about at the beginning, right? If it's if you're in a boat and you have some like higher voltage, you have to just kind of design for that margin all the way through your product, it sounds like.
Yeah. So then you're blocking twice 90 volts. So you're blocking 180 volts. Then we have some nasty reverse recoveries depending on the signs and stray inductance and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And does that get worse because these are bigger diodes as well, like the recovery and things like that?
Yeah, maybe the recovery is a bit worse because of that, but also because of the design itself. It's, you have one big transformer, you have some copper bars going to the diodes, you have some copper bar going from the diode to the output inductor. Mm-hmm. So
it's just all copper because it's got to be as low resistance as possible.
Yeah. Wow. So it's a lot of copper bars on the as a side note, I worked at Kraft PowerCon, I worked like with encryption and telecommunication stuff, so it was all really low power. Then I come here and my first day at work, I'm in the out in the lab with a big wrench connecting cables, and the That's cables great. Are like 120 square millimeters and So after the secondary diodes, you go to a big inductance to because you have a square wire basically coming out from the from the transformer.
Right, you're not like softening edges to lower your EMC or anything like that, right?
No. So it goes into the inductance, which makes it more into like a sawtooth form from the square wire. Yeah, and on the way, I think it's after the. You also have a current sensor to sense the output current.
As it not a sense resistor at 0.000001 ohms.
No, you can have shunts, but you need to cool them.
Right.
In this case, it's usually a LEM sensor. They make Hall effect sensors.
Okay.
So we have both closed loops and open loops. The closed loops are more accurate. And they're a bit more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I always imagine that with the current sensors, I always think about them as clamp sensors and things like that. You know, they're the coils going around a wire or something like that, like not precision at all. And then it must get harder as you're trying to get more precise.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And you also have some caps on the output to take care of some of that ripple.
And so that you mentioned the sawtooth on the output,
mm-hmm.
Is that what you expect to see then? So if you were brave enough to stick a scope on the output, would you see like, is it like a...
You see a like a 20 amp sawtooth before the output capacitors.
Okay.
So they are taking in that current.
The caps are handling that sawtooth and helping to smooth it out?
Yeah. Huh. So in the end, on the output, you have less than 1%. So if you have a 300 amp output, you have 3 amps maybe that's left.
Oh my gosh. So how much of this is like, is any of this on a PCB, or is this all just like up on pegs or some kind of like individual elements?
Yeah. It's all on like copper bars and the connections.
Mm-hmm. So like standoffs and things like that.
Yeah, copper plates and connecting stuff. The primary board has the current going through it, but we are only talking about 14 amps in that board, right. Or in this current product, maybe it's 35 amps of primary current. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Only 35 amps, right? Right. Yeah. So low. Yeah. So then you must have to. So you're then monitoring this stuff using that current sensor,
yeah.
And you're doing some kind of control then to then like feed that back what, back around the transformer with isolation or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. So we have some isolation going on to but the current sensor is isolated by design. It goes around the bar and it has no contact, so it's isolated. But we also sense the output voltage. So the output voltage and the output current is going back to the control board that sits at the front of the module next to the primary board. Mm-hmm. So it will read that, it will feed it into its PID regulator, and it will increase or decrease its pulse width depending on that. Wow. So and we run, in that case, we run two regulators in parallel, one for voltage and one for current. Okay. And whoever says it wants the smallest wave for, PWM it wins. Okay. So that's how you can cap on both. The customer can set, I want 12 volt and 200 amps. And if it gets 200 amps, it will stop at that point, even if the voltage is maybe 3 volt. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it will, the resistance is different, so it goes up to 10 volts or 12 volts and regulates on that one. So, and it can also be that if you know, if you remove the, if you're doing the plating and you're putting stuff into the bath and you're removing stuff from the bath, the resistance changes. Right. So you need to limit both the current and the voltage. So you have set points for both.
Got it. I have to say, like, even though it sounds like a closed loop system because you are sensing on the, you know, the secondary side and feeding it back, and it's like it is closed loop, but it almost feels like it's open loop because you're just like, well, hope this changes is how we need it to, you know. It's like, I mean, and like, what is the propagation time as well from, like, you know, from sensing a change to then getting it back around and actually impacting the difference? Like, do you have a spec on how fast you'd expect to be able to respond to a change?
Yeah, we basically respond in the next pulse. So the switching if the switching frequency is 37 kilohertz, you have like 27 microseconds. Wow. So you sense it and you do some calculations on it and you regulate your PWM.
And when you said pulse too, you mean that, like, so we have the PWM, is it continuous PWM going, or is it are these actually pulses that are happening?
No, it's continuous. Yeah.
So it is. Okay.
Yeah. So react quite rather instant. And
And so when you do a pulse, like you're talking about, like for the copper bath, for like plating those tiny vias, so is that also driven from the primary side and you're doing like a pulse at a time? You're like saying, hey, we're only going to turn on for this short amount of time and then turn back off?
Yeah, in that case, there's a little bit of extra stuff coming into the picture. Then it's another product. So we base it on the high current power module.
Sure. Yeah.
So the high current power module supplies the 300 amps. And in that case, I think it's 30 volt. And then it goes into a pulse module, and the pulse module has a lot of capacitors. So it basically it stores that energy. I don't know how many they are, but there's a lot of them. And then there's a H-bridge on that pulse module that actually sends that power out. And the output of the product is like 5 volt at maximum, but the actual voltage that it's working with is 30 volt. And it's because it needs to create those really sharp edges. If you didn't have that high drive voltage, it wouldn't be a square wave. It would be a sine wave coming out. Mm-hmm.
And so it just like snaps off when it gets to the point where it needs like 30 volts. So it climbs super fast, but then you snap it off using the H-bridge or whatever.
Yeah. So that is a separate regulator. That one needs to be really fast. You don't get the overshoot and things like that.
Yeah.
I was looking into that product just a couple of weeks ago, and I was not here when they made that one. Maybe it's 10 years old. It's written in assembly, and it's like, okay, we're adding some features here. Let's not touch that part and try to, it works, let it be, and see what we can add. And and that one was also interesting because it's like an old processor. I think it's 20 years old or something. And it's like running out of RAM all the time. So it's like, okay, we have 3 bytes of RAM now. Okay, let's do something with that.
Oh my gosh. A new feature.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
One thing that's really obvious to me is like, so obviously you've been very open talking about this stuff too. And it's like, so like this kind of industry, or like when I was working at Keithley too, and it's like, you know, like people come in and like, yeah, maybe you can work on this stuff, but like there's one, there's expertise in people like you, but two, it's just like, it seems like it's so dependent on material sourcing and like tribal knowledge internally of like what it takes to get like super sharp edges, like you're talking about, or build out a supply chain that could, you know, actually make this thing happen on a regular basis.
Yeah. And Kraft PowerCon has been around for a while. It's founded in 1935. So it's 85 years now, and people have come and gone over the years. So
yeah,
I guess the knowledge stays in the company, and, we get new people and we get new ideas, and we continue making the old ones also, trying to support everything. We can get rectifiers from the Swedish Railroad here that was produced maybe 30, 40 years that they want serviced.
Wow. Like they'll come back from them?
They come back and they say, can you fix this one? And I guess it's because maybe they don't want to do a new EMC measurement of the train. So they cannot exchange it to something new without doing new testing.
Right, like a reevaluation. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So they try to get it fixed. And there was one fascinating thing also recently. It was one guy who purchased a car repair shop, and he found this old battery charger. It said Tudor on it, and the Tudor was the name when the company was founded. So somehow he found us and reached out and said, do you know anything about this one? And I went into the archives here and looked around, and I actually found some reference to some metal, front metal plate, and it was from 1937.
Holy moly.
So it was
That's
like
amazing.
On the 4th of January 1937, somebody took up out the drawings number for that front plate. Yeah. Wow. And it's been the same for me.
Did you like at least offer to buy it from him? Be like, we got to put that in our lobby or something.
Yeah. They are trying to buy it now, I think. They want to put it in the lobby. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy that there's, just that kind of longevity in a tech company. You don't hear about that often.
No. And it's even the where the company was before, because it's a mode from one city to another. Suburbs of the Gothenburg.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a fire and in the factory, and they moved to a new place. So some of these documents have survived that fire. So this one was a bit, you can see that it has been wet at some point.
Yeah.
And the history is fascinating. Like when I made a couple of PCBs here, and you go and take a new PCB number, if you scroll back in that paper, you can see PCB numbers that were taken out before you were born.
Wow.
So like, okay, this company has been around for a while, and now
did the company have access to PCB houses earlier than others maybe too, because they were supplying them with copper plating capabilities, so they just were tied into that supply chain?
I'm not sure. I know that we made stuff ourselves here. At least we assembled the PCBs. We had our own assembly line. Later we sold that one to a company that became our supplier. So kind of outsourced it.
Yeah, that happens. And especially usually that always seems to happen when it's like, well, do we want to update from, we can't get through hole parts like we used to, but, do we want to update to an SMT assembly line? It's like, nah, we'll just push that off. And then, someone wants to buy the old assembly line or whatever too. So That's crazy. Wow. So the boards, like I said, the supply chain, it seems like you guys really, you're making a specialized product. You have specialized knowledge about all this stuff. You had emailed me about all this stuff because it was actually when I was started talking about Zephyr.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would send me an email that said Zephyr without the RTOS part.
Exactly. Because you've been talking about Zephyr on the AmpHour, so I got inspired by that one.
So what do you mean by that, though, without the RTOS part?
Yeah, because you were talking about the hardware abstraction. And right now I'm working as a software team leader here at Kraft PowerCon and trying to make the software part a lot more modern and modular and flexible. Because it's a company that everything was analog, and then somebody invented microcontrollers.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And then the EE started writing code and everything went downhill from there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The EE started writing code and they got some kind of ID from the vendor because it was easy, not a lot of tools to install.
That's right.
Yeah, and yep. They write some...
So they're using pick parts, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And they were writing code and then they discovered they need to make another product. So they copied that code to the another product.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And they even didn't even have like version control. Yeah. Maybe it wasn't invented yet. I don't know, but at the beginning, all the code was on the server. So you can see actually they had some rule that if you add a line, you will add a comment about which version you added that line in. So it's like all over the code. You see --, version 1.2, --, version 1.4 for every line.
So instead of like a useful content, comment, it's just the version stuff.
Yeah, there were useful comments, but there were also like the version ones. At least it was a try. Yeah. So then when I started working here, and first I did some hardware stuff and PCBs, but now I'm working more with software, and we're facing like we have 40 different firmwares that we try to maintain. And a lot of them just copies of each other. So if you find a bug in one, you might need to fix that one in three, four, five other ones.
You got to go and put --, 3.2 or --, 3.7, right?
Yeah. No, at least it was in SVN when I started here. So Subversion. But now I'm moving things to like Git and Azure DevOps and trying to make a continuous integration pipeline and all that stuff. Nice.
I'm just imagining people listening right now. And they're like 40 straight minutes of talking about like hardware and like, you know, oh, high power. Yeah, this is awesome. And then boom, firmware. Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. It's an important aspect. And I think it's a really good part of the Ampower that you go into electronics, but you also go into the firmware part.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it feels like it's unavoidable. I mean, like, so obviously you guys are making analog stuff, right? Yeah. And that's a very viable product line. But these days, I just imagine that if you wanted to add new features, you would be doing it with a microcontroller or with, you know, some UI element or some other thing on there. I mean, has that been a tough cultural shift internally?
No, not so tough to shift to that, but maybe tough to see the value. People are starting to see the value in software now. Maybe you can offer them not a display that displays current and voltage. You can offer them a display that's fit to your process. You can say, I want 5 micrometers of copper, or I want this amount of hypochlorite for my ballast water treatment. So you can tailor the display and the GUI to the process to provide value that way. I think that's one important. The other important things that software brings is the ability to push out fixes. So if some customer has a problem with the regulator, oh, you need to change the P or I or D constants of the regulator on the old one, you had to send a guy out to solder some resistors.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now they can do it through the menus. Uh-huh. And there has been a couple of cases where, we discovered a problem, and then it's like, we need a hardware fix. Can you do something on software in the meantime? And then I come up with a fix that mitigates the problem until we can push exchange some boards or something. Just to always try to help the customer in the fastest way possible.
Yeah, I mean, like line down situations are just so detrimental to production.
Yeah,
I can imagine that you would get very angry phone calls if something's not working as
exactly. So as the product flora it grows, we get more and more products, and it gets harder and harder to maintain them. So that's where I thought about, okay, we should really make this modular. If we have like a Canvas implementation, why not have the same in all products?
And so it's not currently, you're saying? There's individual.
They're individuals. They're like copies of each other, and they're also individual implementations. So try to make it more modular, easier to maintain. And when you make stuff modular, you start thinking about the API between them, the interfaces. Yep. How can I abstract the interface of this module to work with any other module that I want to connect it to?
Yeah, the API is just the connector of the software world.
Yeah,
which pin is which?
Yeah, exactly. So recently, I think it was this spring, we hired a new software guy called CCS, and he had worked with AUTOSAR in the automotive industry. So he had some background in like modular design, and we were thinking about that. But people start shivering or something like that when you mention AUTOSAR. It's not the nicest experience for some people, I guess.
What is it called again?
AUTOSAR. It's a framework for automotive.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I guess I'd have to, I'll look that up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I have heard Zephyr mentioned a couple times on the Amp Hour. So I started looking into it. It's like, it looked really good. It has really good hardware abstraction. And we said to each other, well, why don't we make it like that? And I think it was like the day after that I listened to the Amp Hour and you and Dave were talking about it. And I was like, we are trying, because we said that if we make our modules in with the Zephyr abstraction, we cannot reuse them if we start to use Zephyr also. So it's like, yeah, we have something to follow and we don't invent it from, take something that works. Instead, if you try to invent it, you have to iterate over it to get it working. Here you have a reference. You can just implement like that reference.
Right. Yeah. So so you're just re-implementing like a API layer, and you're not gonna, so you were saying you're not necessarily going to use the whole framework. You're not going to use everything from it, because I think you said it was specifically because of timing requirements. Is that right?
Yeah. It's like some of the products are set up in a specific way. So you have like, it's done with interrupts right now. So maybe you have a 1 kilohertz interrupt, 100 hertz interrupt and a 10 hertz interrupt, and they do different things. And there's some priority maybe to the faster one, the slower one do some communication stuff. And even in the power module, you have the 37 kilohertz interrupt. That's really important. That must always be served. So if you're going to put it in R2OS, I don't see the immediate benefit for us. Maybe we can get it to work, but if we don't need it, why go for it?
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, I'm a bit tempted, because it provides a really good hardware layer also.
Sure, sure. But so this seems like this is one of those scenarios where like you have to hit your timing, right? Like, so that 37 kilohertz over the 27 microseconds, like you cannot miss that train as it goes by the station. No. Right?
Things will go boom.
that's bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were just looking into, like, now we're implementing like something called Profibus, which is a field bus used in industry. Yeah. They have a lot of buses in industry. So that one will talk to a specific ASIC, Profibus ASIC on SPI. So as we make this Profibus module, the SPI calls that it will do will be Zephyr compatible. So we make our SPI driver that way also. So we could just take that Profibus module into Zephyr and it would work right off the bat.
Nice. Yeah. And so like if you push that code upstream, then someone else could pull that down at some point and use that to talk to that same chip, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly, through Zephyr. Yeah. So that's why I think it seemed really a really good choice, because we've also been thinking about R2OS maybe for not the power modules, but on the stack level. You have a controller that's talking to the display, talking out to the PLC. And as I was listening to the embedded, they discussed about where to use an R2OS, and they had some good arguments for like whenever you have communication, I think they said, Alicia and Chris.
I think that's a good guideline. I mean, and so how does that work like internally then? So you have a processor, like you're a real-time processor. Your thing that's handling that 27 microsecond must hit deadline for the switching.
Yeah.
Is that like a standalone thing, and then that has an interface to the controller, like you mentioned, or what is, like, how many processors are in the system?
Yeah, there's one on each power module, and that one has its 37 kilohertz, and it's getting its set points from the stack controller, and it sends it down either analog in some products, so it's sampled by an ADC, or it sends it down by CAN bus. And that value might be stored in like a global variable, so when the 37 kilohertz interrupt fires off, it has the latest value in some global variable that it will just read. So I think a lot of information between the interrupts are exchanged through global variables.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. I was just wondering, like, so you mentioned not wanting to use an RTOS because of that. And then I was just thinking, like, sometimes when there's like something that's so time and critical, you could put a processor just doing that one thing and making sure that it's always hitting that. But then it could have another interface that's going out to like, you know, like you're like the, it sounds like the architecture like you're doing, and that could maybe do an RTOS or whatever you needed because it's doing communications. Or
I've been thinking in the terms of that, because you have this TI line of processors where they have some real-time units on them. They have some different cores just to do some really critical tasks.
Oh, like the PRUs, like
the, yeah,
like
the PRUs. The... Yeah, I was thinking about the PRUs, and it's like, oh, maybe I could use the PRUs to do the switching of the IGBTs, and then I can use run Linux or something on the other one. It's not so critical.
Or like when Jay was on the show, he was talking about that the STM32 MP1, I think it is. And it's got like a Cortex M4 on board that just does the real time stuff.
Yeah, actually, so. I have a board with MP1 here.
Oh,
and also
nice. How do you like it?
Yeah. I haven't played so much with it, but
TBD.
Yeah, exactly. You get a lot of stuff that you want to do, and you not always have time for them. But in that case, we thought about it because we have an STM32 F4 on the stack controller that's responsible for talking to the power modules. So if you switch that one to an MP1, you could basically transfer all the code directly into the F4 part of the MP1, and then you can use the rest of the MP1 for the display and the connectivity and other fancy stuff. You could use, like, I believe it's really useful to use Linux on those parts, because it's you have a lot of connectivity for free in this.
Right. And then you don't have to worry about the real-time aspect.
It's handling itself. So
how do you analyze all this stuff? I mean, how do you, obviously you're, if it doesn't go boom, it's good. But like, how are you watching all the cycles and testing this stuff on the bench and like making sure that you're hitting your timing?
Yeah, you put your oscilloscope on the things and you measure it. Like you must measure like the dead time between the switch pulses. Because if they're on at the same time, they will go boom. So you can set put some dead time into the PWM's blocks of the STM32. Mm-hmm. And then you measure and put out maximum PWM, and you can have a current sensor on it, but you can also put the oscilloscope directly on the IGBTs with some high voltage probes and some isolation transformer on the oscilloscope itself. Or you have isolated probes.
You mean you don't want to like chassis ground the whole thing?
No, not really.
Through the scope probe? Yeah, I've done that one.
It's like I've seen both. You have the isolated probes. That's good. But if you don't have that probes, you can put your like high voltage probes. But you need to make sure you're not touching the BNC connectors on the scope. Yeah. If they're connected to the 700 volt DC line of the power module.
Yeah, it's a good way to waste an oscilloscope.
Yeah. Need to measure that one, and then like there's some overcurrent protections. You need to verify that one works. So
yeah,
create a shortcut.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm wondering about. Is like you're setting up guardrails for yourself. It seems like, you know, making sure that A, B, C, and D don't happen.
Yeah.
But then how do you validate that? It sounds like you have the test set up for that.
You test it up and you start on a low voltage. So the voltage the voltage we have in the lab, you can just turn it down to maybe you start at 24 volt AC and you go up as you
got
see
it.
It's working.
Yeah.
But me personally, sometimes when there's some new stuff I must test and I know everything should work, it's faster. It's faster to just go for it. Either it works or it blows up, and then you start on the lower voltage. But if you start on the lower voltage and do all the verification when you don't need it, it takes more time. So it depends.
Who's got time? You know, I've got more stock than I've got time.
Yeah, but of course, on a new product, you start on that one. But when you have a working product and you need to change something, sometimes I put on the hearing protection and the protection glasses and I go for it.
Oh, I'm just imagining like you have like a repair tech out on the floor and like oh, Frederick's doing some testing. You just like, you're just walking out and dropping like smoking boxes on their desk over and over again.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it seems like the testing is like a really critical part of all this, but like,
yeah.
Do you have any kind of like automation in that realm? I mean, you talked about like doing some continuous integration stuff. Like, are you working towards the like the bench testing side of things as well? Like automation on that side of things?
Yeah. So if you look into software, we're looking into doing more and more like unit testing for all the modules, because if you make all this mm-hmm. hardware abstraction, you can unit test very easily all the mm-hmm. modules. You have a nice abstraction layer, and then you go down to the lower levels. At some point you need drivers for the hardware, and then we're looking into making more like hardware either you make hardware boards with all the different like I have a DAC on one product, so I have a module for that DAC. I could just make a test board with that DAC on it, so I can download the firmware, like nightly builds and test them.
Got it. And then have that go into some, like a DMM or something like that, that's like tracking it.
But since we have production, we also have a lot of automated tested in production. So for our PCBs, we are setting up test jigs that do automated testing, or depending on the volume, if it's a low volume board, it's many manual, and the when it goes to high volume, it becomes automated. Mm-hmm, yeah. That testing is done by our supplier. So we are like developing a test stand and send it to them. So they run it.
Okay. At the CM, you mean like they'll have that as part of their like acceptance testing?
Yeah. Mm. So the boards, when they come here, they should work. And we are monitoring that and making sure we're not having too high, too low yield. Like then you mm-hmm. need to think about, should we, we should probably add another test because something it's missed by the test. So if you can make all the boards that's not working, getting stuck at the CM, they will take care of their process because they want high yield. So,
And so what are the actual outputs? So one of the modules that you might be testing at the CM using a test board, that would have not like a DAC output, but it would actually have like maybe like the pulse output that's driving IGBT. Is that kind of the thought there?
Yeah. So like if you look at the primary board, the CM, they have like a mini variant of the power module. They have a 24 volt AC input to that board, and it's mm-hmm. switching, and then we're measuring and making sure everything works, that the pulses are correct, and like that. So then it gets verified that part. Then the board comes here, it gets assembled into a power module, and then the power module goes into a module tester here that's automated. And then the power modules gets assembled into a stack, and then that stack goes to the final testing, which also an automated test, but with personal, because you need to connect a lot of cables and cooling water, because you have both water cooled and air cooled. Mm-hmm. The final test should just pass without problems because
each individual piece is good.
And we can see them as the customer. This is how it should work at the customer, so it should mm-hmm. be no faults at the final testing. You need, and we run it for like an hour or so to make sure it heats up and it works. Like mm-hmm. I guess you test drive a car when you manufacture it.
That's right. So you've mentioned the stack a couple times too. Is that just mm-hmm. to like get parallel versions of the same board doing like the same amount of current? Is that the thought there?
Yeah, that's the power of the modular design. So mm-hmm. we put a lot of modules in a stack, and the stack can be configured as parallel output or serial output.
And that's how you can
For example, the marine products, they often use a bit higher voltage, so they have 50 volt modules, but you can connect four outputs in series to get 200 volt. And then you can, so if each module has two outputs, so on its own it can do 100 volt, and then you take it in series with another module to get 200. And then you can make five of those groups in a stack in parallel, so you have 200 volts and 100 amps, and you do five of those configurations in parallel, so you get 500 amps. So 200 volts, 500 amps, it's 100 kilowatts.
Wow. And then, is the transformer in each case of those, is the transformer on the actual power module itself? Or is there like some larger transformer?
No, there's one in each, actually two in each, since they have two outputs. So the power stage, so one power module is 10 kilowatt in that case, and each power mm-hmm. stage is 5 kilowatt. And then you connect a lot of them. So That's also one thing we identified when we made a product recently that we made into 20 kilowatt, because it was like, okay, what are the customer requirements? What are the stage? What are the steps they would require? Because if you make the power stage too small, you make a lot of measurements, you make a lot of transformers, a lot of current sensors, a lot of voltage sensors, which adds cost to the product. So the less control logic, because the essence of the product is to deliver power. So in that case, 20 kilowatt was a good fit. But so it depends how flexible you want to be regarding or versus the cost of the production.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the trade-off in modular design is like, how atomic do you want the unit to be? It's like you could say like, oh, well, I'm going to use just like breakout boards for every single chip on the board, and then everything is super modular. And it's like, okay, that works. But then you have, in that example, you know, the added cost of interconnects and extra PCBs and everything else. You might get benefit from being able to switch out every chip, but then the overhead to do so is like really, really high. So it's like, where do you kind of draw the boxes around these systems?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also then it becomes quite interesting when you have a lot of these power modules connected in a stack and you want to regulate the output current or the output voltage. Mm-hmm. So because if you put them in parallel, they will all see the same voltage, the common voltage on the output, but you still want to regulate it, and you want them to be able to supply the same amount of current. Mm-hmm. Because if one module puts out 50 volt and the other module sees that, and it's like, oh, it's 50 volt on the output, so my PWM is zero, then everything is fine.
Right. So they need to like be aware of like where they are in the stack as well then? Is that the kind of the thought?
Yeah, they need to be aware where they are to know if they are in series. Because whether you need to figure out the configuration, so you configure it in the menu, and then you need to like, okay, if it's series connection with two modules, then every other module is a slave to the one above, things like that. So there's a lot of stuff going into that, and then going into like current sharing when you're in parallel.
Right. Yeah, you don't want one to be doing, you know, 100 amps, the other one's doing 5 amps or something, right?
Yeah, and when you're in series, instead, everybody sees the same current. So you must make sure that they actually supply the voltage they are supposed to supply. Because the current from the module before will go through the module after it. And yeah, it's the same current in the loop when you're in series. So
then how does that play back then in the software realm then? So like you're saying you want to modularize everything on the software side. Mm. Does that mean that like you also have to push that stuff all the way back up the system?
Yeah, there's some stuff going on, like have like a current share master, for example, that's looking at maybe one module has that role, and it's looking at, okay, when I'm outputting 50 volt and the current is 100 amp, okay, let's tell everybody to run 100 amps. So in that case, one module is running in voltage control and the other ones are running in current control. So there's like a PID in that one to make sure they slowly ramp up to the correct current to get 50 volt on the output, for example. And when you're serious, there are like different ways you can solve it. You can one module can see, okay, when I get this current, I have this voltage, so I can tell the other modules to run this voltage, and you must make sure the whole system doesn't oscillate and things like that. So
Yeah, because I imagine some of these loads are very interesting, like in capacitive or inductive kind of, probably capacitive mostly, right, if they're big tanks.
Yeah, tanks, yeah, they're quite resistive, and there's some problem when the material goes in and out of the bath.
Oh yeah, right.
And then in the high voltage, just two big metal plates, so they are very capacitive. And then you have sometimes long cables, which adds inductance, and
So that plays havoc with your PID loops, I'm sure.
yeah, for sure.
Well, that's this is quite an interesting field. I wouldn't have guessed that, like, you know, like you say, like switch mode power supplies, and it's like, oh, okay, that I think I understand that. But then like the range of like how it's being put to use, it's like, it's really quite crazy.
It's big, you know, stuff. Like if you look at the final tester area, there's like big copper bars in the ceiling going to the load. Mm-hmm. It's like I ran one test with like two or three stacks of power modules, and it was like 12,000 amps of output current. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, there's a lot of power.
Yeah.
Controlled by software. So yeah.
That's what's, yeah, that's also kind of crazy about it too. You know, like just oh, okay. One bit's wrong, and yeah. Well, like you said, it goes boom.
Yeah, so you need to put a lot of care into that, and yeah.
Well, Frederick, what else should we know about this field? I mean, it seems very interesting. I mean, are you guys are you hiring? Are you looking for more people?
Yeah, at least on the I know that on the software side, we are looking for more people because mm-hmm. we are three people now, and as I said, it's like 30 or 40 different firmwares, and people starting to realize the value of good mm-hmm. software. So yeah, I haven't got the go ahead to recruit, but we are looking for interesting candidates.
If the right resume happens to find its way across your desk, you're not going to say no, right? You might push it up the ladder, you know?
Yeah, usually when you get a really good candidate, you usually can get an exception.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, look, a position just opened up. Who knew? How did this happen?
Exactly. And I would really like to get more competence in the area of regulation loops and stuff like that. So if anybody's really good in that area. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So like PID control
and
stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're starting to doing more like active PFCs, and then you have like six IGBTs that you're going to control with software to get that PFC running. And
it's power factor control, you mean?
Yeah.
Exactly. PFC?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like you're not, when you are in a, you're not like making your grid go sideways. Like an idea.
Exactly. And it can actually increase the efficiency of the product, so you can have higher efficiency.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, I think that is the right way forward. I mean, like that, you can really start to have finer and finer control of like these really big things, but it's like you can get a lot more out of it, it seems like.
Yeah, I must say I listened to episode 520, inductance and stuff, and you started talking about the compute module 4 again a little bit. And that one you also mentioned on the episode that I was listening to about Zephyr. I think it was episode 514. Yeah. So we're looking into that as well to add a compute module to control our displays. And so it was quite fascinating. I was listening to you talked about Zephyr, and then I went to work and we started discussing how should we control this display. Oh, there's something new called a compute module 4. And then on the way home, I listened to the last part of the episode and you guys started talking about it. And
Maybe we're just listening to you here. You know, it goes both ways, I think.
Maybe
it's the zeitgeist of the electronics scene, it seems like.
So on the last episode, I listened to the 520, you talked about routing the differential pairs for the HDMI stuff.
Yeah,
so that was quite interesting. And I listened to Rick Hartley, thanks to you also. He has a really good YouTube video about what your differential pairs wish you knew.
Okay. I don't know if I've seen that. Rick Hartley's the signal integrity guy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And apparently there were some guys at John Deere that had tested this, because apparently they do this stuff in farming equipment also. Okay. So it was quite fascinating to listen to that one. And I think you can... On an HDMI signal, you can skew it by 3 millimeters. But one example was like a 100 megahertz signal. You can skew it plus minus 55 millimeters. and it will still work. So,
wow. Yeah. Okay.
So not always that critical. Also I think Jay Carlson
talked
about.
Yeah,
that's
kind of what Jay Carlson was talking about. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. You know, that's good to know. Like even though, you know, like having a little margin.
Yeah.
In the proverbial, digital signals not going boom.
No.
That's good to know, right?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Well, Frederick, thank you for thanks for listening to the show, and thank you for writing in and being on the show. This is like super interesting.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're doing some really cool stuff there. Yeah. So I hope people reach out to you. Where can they find you if they're interested in maybe pushing a resume across your desk?
Then they should find me on LinkedIn in that case, I guess.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'm mostly on Facebook. So yeah. There's only one Frederick Cansander in the world that I know about. So, you should probably find me.
Okay. Well, thank you, Frederick. It's been great having you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great to be on the show, and I'm a big fan of the show, so it's really fun.
Thanks. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk to you. Bye.
Talking about high power stuff today, we realized nothing makes us feel more powerful than having the backing of our audience on these shows. Join the other patrons keeping and getting current each week via patreon.com/theampower. A special thanks today to our corporate sponsor, Beanyo.